This is Jason Horsley for the Liminalist, the podcast in between. Speaking today with Elena Nikitina. Yes. So before we get into your experiences that you write about in the book, I thought it would be very interesting, as interesting even, to talk a little bit about your experiences growing up in Russia, because you grew up in a really critical time.
I don't have bad memories at all. To be honest, it was critical, but for Russian people, I think it was what it was, and we didn't, as me being young, I didn't think in that perspective. You know, it was our life, and we didn't know any better. So,
Well, you were born what, in the mid 70s?
73, actually.
73. So when the communist system collapsed, you were 14 or something?
I still got that part when it was almost communist system, communism. It was socialism, actually, like to be exact. It was socialism. And it was okay. The system was okay. My mom was, you know, working at a very good place, and we were happy family. It wasn't anything terrible. When the USSR collapsed, then it kind of gradually turned into the, you know, corruption and in all the terrible, things. But before that, it was actually very good. Everyone was happy. You know, we didn't have that much crime or nothing. Maybe we did, but it wasn't that, it was not on the TV all the time. But in the 90s, that's when it got really bad.
Right. Yeah, well, of course, most people who didn't grow up in Russia or in any kind of communist country have, you know, an outsider's view, and a lot of it is propaganda, I would guess. I mean, there certainly was a lot of propaganda in the Western world about communism and Russia and how terrible it was, and I think there still is to this day. It was interesting. I mean, in your book, you only refer to it in passing, but you refer to it as the context for what happened to you, as in, as you just summed up, really, that when the USSR collapsed, society went into a period of chaos, and out of that chaos, well, many things came, but one of them being your specific, the experience that happened to you, kind of required those conditions for it to happen. And one of my interests on this podcast, I mean, why I chose the word liminal, is in this sort of area between structure and order and organization and total chaos. And that's what the word liminal means. It means anti-structure. So it means when the structures start coming undone and potentially like a new order, and new order is not a good phrase, but a new kind of form of social organization can arise from that, or a new way of experiencing reality. But there's always going to be a period of destabilization. So it did occur to me while reading your book that it might seem as though the collapse of the USSR was, even though we in the West saw it as a positive thing, of course, because it affirmed our value system, For people in the USSR, it may have been experienced as in the opposite way as anything but positive.
Okay, first of all, thank you for reading my book.
You're
I hope
welcome.
you enjoyed, yeah. I hope you enjoyed that. When I was growing up in USSR, you can imagine we had free medicine, free schools, free apartments, like everything came like free, you know. Everyone who worked, everyone was happy with the system, even though it slowly was going into something, you know, else, because people can't have that much things for free. So it had to end somehow, all this free stuff. And the political system also was not perfect. And all of a sudden, it's in from my perspective, because I was young and, you know, ordinary student. All of a sudden, it came to an end, but it was not to the best, of course. It was just, as you said, chaos, like ultimate chaos. Because nobody knew how to fit in that society and that system, because we were wearing pink glasses, you know, for years, and all of a sudden, people didn't know how to live in that society, and I think that's why so many. I think the new wave of crime came and covered the country, like all of a sudden in days, you know, during the weeks, like maniacs. Nobody even heard about maniacs before 90s, and all of a sudden, all those abductions, kidnappings, murders, you know, these drug addicts, they came out of nowhere and spread in the country. It was a little disturbing. The time was disturbing because we didn't know that they existed before, all those people, you know.
Right.
Yeah, it was a disturbing time and hard time.
So we're talking about the period, your period of growing up, of coming of age, right? So in 87, you would have been 14, and then the period that you were abducted was 94. So literally that key period of adolescence to adulthood, this is the period that we're talking about, yeah, when your whole environment was transforming.
Yeah, it's you know what? I don't remember. I paid that much attention to political situation in country. I was just, you know, was growing up, just doing my own things, and I didn't really feel, you know, I don't know. It's hard to say. You want what exactly is your question? So you.
Well, just I mean, in the specifics, say like when I was 14, that was when I started going out to pubs and nightclubs and smoking and drinking, and that was just what everyone did, and it was a normal thing. But wasn't there a change in the degree of freedom that you had or would have had versus what you would have had because of the collapse of the USSR? At that time in your life, like when didn't it mean that you were able to explore opportunities that you wouldn't have had if the system hadn't collapsed? That's one of the things I'm wondering about.
I don't know. I was involved with my boyfriend, and I was full in love, and everything was so good and felt really nice. So I just don't know. Yeah, I was wild, of course. I was trying to smoke, and you know, maybe started trying to drink, but it wasn't a big deal, you know. It's a regular thing for people our age, but
Okay, so that didn't change radically then, as far as what teenagers were doing at that time.
No, I was normal. I was pretty normal. Nothing outrageous, normal things. And I don't know. That's why probably this change from my ordinary, normal life that I didn't even think about, society or system. And then when my life turned upside down, then I kind of started figuring out that it's just, what life is about,
Yeah.
what life is,
And were you aware, like before you were abducted, before what happened, were you aware of a danger and a threat around you and the possibility, or did it really literally just come out of nowhere?
No, of course not. Of course, for me, to begin with all these changes in the country, every citizen, including myself, we were watching news every day, and they were constantly on the news. They were constantly showing cases of abduction for ransom, like all around in every city. I knew about that, but for me, it seemed so distant. It seemed like something that could never happen in my own life. Because all these cases, there were some people who had money, they were involved, in that cases, or some gangsters or criminals. And for me, it was horrible, of course. It was beyond, horrible. But for me, it was something really distant. I would never imagine I could be in that, in that situation. So.
And as you describe it in the book, it was almost a misunderstanding, essentially, that you were abducted. I mean, certainly they made a mistake in terms of you actually having value or there being any way to get money out of abducting you. So, I mean, do you want to describe that a little bit? Like what the circumstances, as far as you understand them, where that led to you being chosen to be abducted?
Yeah, I spent a couple pages in the book trying to explain people what had happened actually. I think we were victims of the system. With all these changes in the country, the banking system also drastically changed, and not for good. And my mom worked in a bank, and she just appeared in the wrong place in the wrong time, and like everything, we were in the wrong place and the wrong time. That's why. Yeah, if you're familiar with that part of the book where I describe the system itself, how this fake paperwork were going from Chechnya to Russia. It was a huge deal for the country. I mean, so much money were washed. I don't know how you laundered or how you call that.
Yeah, laundered, yeah.
Yes. From Chechnya to Russia and back, and that's how they got so much money out of it. And so many people were in prison after that. The banking, the clerks, like so many people, because everybody got involved somehow, and money were spent to my opinion, to buy weapons and support war. For the first Russian-Chechen war.
Right.
Yeah, the people were just really creative to kind of build that perfect, you know, perfect system to get the money out of Russian banks.
Right. And so your mother was in a position to help that in one particular instance, and she said no. Is that right?
She got that fake aviso, you know, the money that should be cashed, and
Right.
she kind of felt that it was like a little fishy. And she went to the we had different. She worked in a little like sister bank, the part of the big center bank, which was in the center of the city. And she got that fake paperwork, and she was supposed to cash that check, cash those money. And she kind of felt not right about that. And she went to the bank, to the center bank, and they kind of put it on hold. You know, they could even be involved. The center bank could even be involved with the gangsters that time, because so many people afterwards, so many people were in prison when, you know. And this is how it happened. They hold the check, that fake check. My mom was still in the bank, and those guys, those captors, they probably thought that she cashed the check,
Right, and took the money for herself.
and yes, kept the money for herself. This is how many, many clerks had done the business. When it all came and everybody knew how the thieves did the process, you know, many clerks kind of took advantage of it and cashed checks by themselves, and you know, some of them escaped to out of country or somewhere else. So, you know, it was
Right.
chaos in the bank. It was just terrible, terrible, terrible time.
So it's like your mother's honesty. I mean, obviously, she was being honest by turning in the check or drawing attention to the falsity of the check, but also she was honest in the sense that she didn't take the money for herself. Where and the kidnappers, I guess it didn't even occur to them that somebody would be that honest.
You know, it was so much money that she probably didn't even have that money in a bank to cash. It was too much money for that little bank. And of course, she was working as an accountant for many, many years. She's a very, you know, hardworking lady, very respectful. Yeah, and she just went to ask for the advice, and she got the feeling. But she always has some feelings about things, you know, my mom.
Is she still alive?
Yeah, she's
That's
here.
good. She's there in the US.
Yes, she's here. So,
And she
yeah.
had some sort of premonition about what was going or what had happened to you, is that right?
Yeah, she always been like that. You know, she believes in all this voodoo things, dreams and premonitions. Yeah, I like myself. Yeah, I'm not into that too much. So we
So,
were like a victims, you know, victims of the time. I mean, of the system.
Thank you. So do you see what happened to you as, I mean, certainly the specifics that you're describing, it does seem like quite random and, you know, incompetence on the part of the abductors and really just a bad mistake all round. But now that you've been through it and come out the other side, do you still see it as just crazy random event, or do you assign some sort of meaning to it in your own life?
I said, it's us being in a, you know, in the victims of the system, I think, nothing else.
Mm-hmm. And how about the effect that it's had on your life now that, to whatever extent, I mean, we can get into this, but you've come out the other side, you've written a book about it, so I presume that that's helped you to process it and to feel that you've healed from the experience. And so do you see, how do you see the experience now from the other side?
You know, to be honest with you, I would never thought that I would read or discuss or mention those events somehow, somewhere, like never. All these years, you know, I kept it to myself. I haven't even talked to my mom about this because it was so painful for us, for both of us. And I just, you know, locked it deep inside and never let it, you know, go out. And those years, I didn't even try to remind myself about it because it was painful. I knew that, and you know, I never tried. And I don't know. It's just it's so weird. It was like so many events came together to give me the idea to write this book. You know, I went to the movie theater with my daughter to watch the movie, and all the trailers before the movie were true stories. Hmm. Yes, and I was just, the first idea came to me at that time, like a couple years ago, that I also had a story, but I never knew I could write about this or talk about it. And I tried, and I, you know, I thought maybe it's the right time to write and tell my mom how it was there, because she didn't know at all. She mm-hmm. was happy that I was alive. I was happy that I came back home. And I thought that maybe it's the right time to just tell her the truth, how it was there. And it was a hard time for me to start writing. But as soon as I start writing, all my memories and all these words, they came you know, they came by themselves. I was just writing on my computer. Like 40,000 words came during 3 or 4 weeks, and I locked myself in my room and just give it, you know, let it go. Yeah.
You abducted yourself.
Yeah, it was a little difficult because I lived it again from beginning to the end, but it was so worth it. You know, right now I understand that the writing, I thought before that to write this book would be good therapy for me, but mm-hmm. right now I understand that I was wrong, because the true magical therapy happened after this, when people sending me their feedbacks. You know, I hear mm-hmm. so many good, not even the right word, amazing, heartwarming, like, you know, words. And this is a true therapy for me.
Right. So that has to do with being heard and received, I think. Like, it's not enough just to articulate our experience. We need somebody to hear it and receive it in a way that is meaningful to us.
Yes, I would never thought it would be so that I can touch people's feelings or people's lives by just my book. Mm. And everybody finds something for themselves in that book. And this is truly magical. This is truly amazing to, you know, to feel that energy.
Mm. And who was the first person to read your manuscript?
My mom.
Okay, that was what I was wondering. So that was how you communicated it to her.
During the process of writing, of course, I needed facts from her, and it was very hard for us to get together, and I started questioning her here and there because I needed some, you know, dates and some events that I couldn't, so to get together. Yes, it was a little disturbing for us, but when I wrote it in Russian, my mom was the first reader. Yes, she cried a lot, of course, but I'm glad that she knows right now.
Mm. Yeah, of course. And how did you move from writing it down in Russian almost for yourself and for your mother? How did that extend to having it written in English, and I think the help of Patrick, who contacted me, and then the publication? How did all that come about?
Yes, I just, you know, everything happens for a reason in our life. And I found Patrick, he's my best friend, one of my best friends right now. It's amazing how we started working together. And right now we just call each other every week, and we just the best friends. And I found him very accidentally, I could tell. And I sent him my Russian, you know, pages in Russian, and he translated into English, you know, broken English.
And he speaks Russian.
No. I translated my Russian pages into English, into broken English, because I translated it really immature, you know, not really good. And he doesn't speak Russian at all. He just got that text and beautify it and made it nice, and then I worked, he sent it back, and I worked on my Russian text just to make it even, you know. It was quite a process, very interesting though, but it was, yeah, we thought together what to add, you know, what to delete, what parts to add, or maybe some events to add. Yes, and so we were working as a team, and he is just a big helper, and he's a great guy, and he's still helping me to get the publicity. So he found you, or he knew.
Yes, well, there's a story there too. I don't know if Patrick told you, but when I mean, I heard from him through my website. There's a form there that people can answer questions just for fun, and he did that. And I think in that he must have mentioned the fact that a book that he had written called Smoked, I had been working on the screenplay for it
Oh, really?
back in 2008 by just a weird series of events, because I've written lots of scripts, but I've never had them filmed, and I don't have an agent or anything, so nobody knows me as a scriptwriter. But I met somebody who was working on that script, and he was stuck on it, so he asked me to help. So I'd worked on the script, and whether you believe in strange phenomena or not, at that time I was working on my own script, or I'd just finished my own script, which was about a girl who was abducted. It was called Grasshopper, and anyway, I mean, it doesn't have that many similarities to your story, but that the basic premise is a girl who's abducted and kept in a basement. So I was exploring anyway some of my own concerns or preoccupations around that. It was after the Natasha, I forget how to pronounce her last name, but there was a famous case in Germany, I
Yeah,
think.
I remember. Yes, I don't remember her name, last name.
Natasha Kay, anyway, let's call
Yeah.
her. That got my attention, and that inspired me partly to write this script. But anyway, as I say, it's just one of those things that seems maybe significant to me. And it was after that that I worked on Smoked. And nothing came of the script. I was really happy with my version, but the guy who'd written it first wasn't, so that was the end of it. So then when I heard from Patrick, I was obviously immediately curious that here's this writer that I'd never met or nothing. I hadn't even read his book, to be frank. I'd just worked on the script. And then he mentioned you, and it seemed as though that was sort of why he reached out, but it wasn't really clear if he'd reached out because I'd worked on his script, or, as it later transpired, because he knew you and he wanted to see if I would interview you. And then when I heard what the book was about, I was curious and willing, because it's a subject that has interested me for a long time, and I don't just mean women being abducted. That I would say that was something I was trying to work out in my own conscious, in terms of trauma, really. I mean, that's my main focus as a writer, is the effects of trauma, I would say.
Trauma, yeah. It's we in Russia, there were no any therapists exist at the time who ever could help, or I couldn't even imagine to go to some to get help. It wasn't even a question. It was just I came back and I lived it. I can probably I was traumatized, maybe. I don't know. I don't know. Maybe it's somehow it's probably had an influence on my life. It's hard to say. But I'm not, I'm a happy person, and I love life still, and it happened, and it happened. It's probably one of those things that makes us who we are right now, so bad or good.
Well, yes. I mean, that was where I was going earlier with my question about how you feel about it now. It seems as though I mean, experience of that kind can't fail to have an impact on
Yeah.
us, of course, as you've described. I mean, you were wrenched out of one experience of reality and hurled into another that you'd never imagined would be possible for you.
Yeah.
So, I mean, and the way you describe it in the book, it's very powerful, that it's like you're forced to become a different person because the circumstances are just so radically different.
Yes, true. And I love being a survivor. It's a, right now I can call myself a survivor. So many years I did not even touch that topic at all. So right now I can openly say I'm a survivor, and I love being a survivor. So I'm not a victim. I'm just, it's my story, and if it somehow can help people to overcome some hardship in life, I really, really would be happy. And
so is that part of why you say you love being a survivor, because there are others out there who identify as survivors and you feel that you can communicate with those others?
Yeah, actually, the book brought some people to me through Facebook, you know, through some social media. They are all survivors. I made friends with them, and they pretty much are human trafficking survivors. It's somehow a little bit, you know, similar to my case, but a little different though. And they're all survivors also. They speak up, and they're happy. But because so many people, they're still victims, you know, people who could not live with this. They, you know, depressed, or they, I don't know. There are some really people who are still down, being, they're still victims, you know, and I'm really happy that I'm a survivor, and I can call myself survivor, not a victim.
Well, I think it has to do, and as you say, some of these people are still victims, and that has to do with the trauma that, if a trauma is too great, yep, then we can't process it. And this is, I would say that most trauma happens in childhood, and it's quite rare for an adult to be really traumatized, for the very reason that as adults we have much stronger defenses, you know, psychological defenses against life, whereas children, particularly very small children, have no defenses, and so those are the traumas that people tend not to get over, and in many cases they don't even remember them. I'd put myself in that category to an unknown degree. And so, although I don't identify as a victim either, I don't deny that if something happened to me as a child, I was a victim, just as you were a victim of kidnapping. I mean, it was done to you, like you didn't have any power to stop it. So in that sense, we were victims at the time that something was happening.
Oh yeah, of course I was a victim big time.
Yeah,
I was like a double victim and triple victim, and I was a victim, of course. But
yeah, well, there's something, you probably haven't heard about it because it's very little known, but coming back to your point about survivors who stay victims, it's called the Adverse Childhood Experiences Study, or ACE. It was a research study that was done in the 90s, 95 actually, just after you were abducted, and they found, you know, it was a very large study, and they found that the correlation, as in the connection between negative childhood experiences, you know, traumatic ones, and even less obviously traumatic, like parents who divorced or parents who were alcoholic, and adult behaviors such as drug addiction, suicide, depression, that these two things were connected in unexpected ways. I mean, just really, really a strong connection there.
Yeah, it's so sad, you know, it's really, really sad. And that's why I think it's really important to, for people who survived, you know, and who were not that traumatized, help people who, you know, who didn't have that much strength, or you know, it's very, very important to speak up about situation like this, you know. Yeah. What's right now, I never heard about human trafficking before, and as soon as I made friends with those people, they post every day, they post that happening, that something about something that happening in this, you know, human trafficking world. It's amazing that in the United States there are so many cases of the human trafficking crime. It's amazing. I could never imagine that it exists here. So in this perfect world, you know. It's amazing that crime still exists.
Yeah, well, yeah, absolutely, and trafficking of children, particularly, I mean, is very prevalent in the U.S. and in the Western world, and very, very well concealed and denied, and but that's the area that I've been researching for the last couple of years, and it's absolutely flabbergasting. And also, I don't know which kind of survivors you've spoken to, because that term can be used by many. People who've survived many different kinds of experience, but in England, it's been coming to light over the last 5 years or so that a lot of this trafficking of children for sexual abuse is
It's unbelievable. They're just slaves. They're sex slaves or labor slaves.
I was gonna say it's happening. It seems it's happening at quite a high level of high political level. It's not criminal organize. Obviously, they are criminal organizations, but I mean, they're criminal organizations who are connected to high levels of government and intelligence and police and all the rest of it, in England at least. But I think it's true in the US too. And it's the kind of thing you just don't read about, because no mainstream press is going to report on that unless it's 20 years after the fact and it's the Catholic Church or something. But in terms of it being an ongoing problem, there's very little out there about it. But there are, it seems like millions of people who are victims of it, whether they were children at the time or adults or both. And a lot of them do identify as survivors. And that, I would say, is the context in which y your own book is going to be received in. As in, you are talking about a problem that is far more widespread than most people are willing to believe, and that very few people are talking about it.
And you know, my book is more about, I think, more about hope than overcoming the trauma. But hope, that's what keeps us, you know, going in situations like mine or others, human trafficking situation. Hope and faith, you know, that's two main things that you have to remember, that it's always, you know, there's always a way to get out or, you know, to stay alive.
нашего лета навсегда.
Well, your experience is kind of bookended because it was like a negative miracle, as in a real fuck up, pardon my French, that got you into the situation in the first place, like a, you know, all like you said, wrong place, wrong time, just all the wrong elements coming together in this
mm-hmm.
one moment, and you ended up in this awful situation. But also the way that you got out of it was a miraculous quality to that also.
It really was. It really was. And, you know, many people ask me what happened. And I can't even tell, because if I knew, I would mention it in a book, because it's still, for me, it's still a miracle. For me, it's just, I don't know. It's just what it is. It's a miracle, truly magical, you know, event. I have no idea what had happened, how it was open, and I still don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe, you know, just God came and opened the door. I don't know. I have no idea. It's a miracle. This is, you know, because I was hoping, I was believing, I was waiting, and I was ready. You know, I was ready because I was always ready to escape or to run, you know, and I just saw the moment, and I could have stayed, you know, I could have. It's so hard for me. Many times I thought for myself, what if I stay inside that pit and didn't go out, even though I knew that it was open? You know, I could have been scared or something like that, you know. But no, it just, you know, something led me, something pushed me. And it's truly a miracle.
Yeah. So do you think that that made a difference, that you escape from that situation in the way that you did, under your own, really under your own power, but also, as you said, something within you or something outside of you was guiding you through that? Do you think that that the fact that it played out that way made a difference as compared to if you'd been rescued, say?
The question is, if I do it by myself?
Well, no, I mean, because as you describe it, you did really do it yourself. Yes, there were these miraculous things that came into, you know, the bombs going off and all the circumstances came together so that you could escape, but you still had to make the choice. You still had to find the courage to leave that situation.
Yeah.
Whereas if you'd been rescued, then you would have never had that opportunity. So I'm wondering if
it just came, magically came to me. The ground was right. And I kind of like felt that it's just the right moment, and that's all. You know,
mm-hmm.
it's all elements came together.
Including your own courage.
Yeah, because I wanted to go home. I think.
Well, I mean, the reason I've zeroed in on that is because one of the things, from what I've discovered about trauma, one of the reasons that people don't get over trauma is that they were powerless and they couldn't do anything about it, and they just stayed, you know, they just had to submit to being victimized. And so that feeling of powerlessness stays with them throughout their life, and they're unconsciously trying to resolve it, trying to find a way to get out of the situation, because they were never able to escape from it as a child. And that, so that makes it this thing that is unresolved, whereas your experience, it did resolve itself, and you resolved it. So it seems that that would make a huge difference psychologically.
Who knows? it's already nobody knows. It just happened. I don't know if it was my power or something else. It just happened, and I'm really happy about that. See, I can laugh about this now, or I can just write and talk to people and talk in front of people. It is also a miracle, you know, that I can do it. Before, like a few years ago, I would never have the courage to speak about it, even remember little pieces were so incredibly painful for me.
Did you feel that throughout the experience, even at the blackest moments, did you feel that there was something supporting you in that, or did you feel there were the times where you felt completely despairing?
You're talking about that time. I didn't quite.
Yeah. While you were abducted, and it seemed as though there was no way out of the situation. I was just wondering, because it was one of the things that I wasn't quite clear on in the book, as you recount it. Like if it had been me, I don't know, my wife would probably disagree. I was going to say I'm not a terribly religious person. Maybe I am, but I'm not conventionally religious, let's put it that way. But if that had been me, I would have spent a lot of time praying.
You know, I wasn't religious also. You know, I grew up, you know, with faith and, you know, beliefs. But I didn't go to church, or I wasn't religious at all. And I don't know, if you would pray all the time, yes, I was hoping to something, to miracle, and you know, in my mind, the miracle, what, it's just, you know, God, because who else, you know? And I didn't, but I didn't like pray all the time. I don't know what, it wasn't. Yes, I just was hoping. More than praying, I was just thinking about my mom most of the time. And I was kind of like praying to her, maybe, more than to God. But I was hoping for miracle to happen. But I wasn't like praying, you know, nonstop. Because pretty much I was in fear all the time and paralyzed by fear, by all this feelings. Yeah, but you know, at some extent, of course, I pray, but I didn't know that many praying pieces to praying words. I was just, it was in my head, you know, just help. I needed help at, you know, in some way, in any face, or any help would help me.
Sorry to interrupt. It's interesting the way that the book it juxtaposes, as in it puts side by side your experiences with your mother's, what she was going through at the time, and of course your mother was praying.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, my mom is religious. She's way more religious than I am, and she was praying all the time, and her prayers were really deep, and sometimes to the oblivion, to unconsciousness. Yes.
You mean that she knocked herself out praying?
Yeah, because she was praying, crying, and she just didn't even remember what, you know, what was happening at that time. And she told me recently, when I was writing the book, she told me all about all these events that I described in the book. She told me, and it is really unbelievable, because I remember that she told me about this lady who gave her candles. This is really, you know, beyond the world, right? This candles, when she light the candles, and I came back when this last candle burned down after a few days. Yeah, this is really unbelievable. But it happened, you know, everything happened. So
what's your sense about that now then? Because at the start of this conversation, you said that your mother believes in voodoo, but you don't. I wouldn't say this is voodoo, by the way, but, you know, the power of the divine to intervene in our lives, let's put it that way. And presumably your mother still believes and feels that that's what happened with you. So where do you stand on that now?
I do believe in God, for sure, because I think, you know, this is the only thing that no one can take from you. And when the time of when the time comes of total despair, this is the only thing you have, right? Only God is the best you can hope for in those terrible events. And it helped, you know, it helped. Maybe I didn't pray, you know, how you have to pray, but I believed, and I had faith, and I hope, and somehow it helped. I think this is the only explanation of me being alive and talking to you right now. It's just some miracle happened. Miracle, I am associating miracle with God only, with God works.
Well, yeah, I think that's technically correct. Yeah, because, you know, human beings and sorcerers and all that can perform supernatural acts, but they're only miracles if they come from God.
Yeah.
So would you say that your sense of the existence of God is stronger for having this experience?
It is, of course. And right now it's even more because there are some other things happened that you clearly can see and feel that it exists. You know, it's really this topic is so personal.
Mm-hmm.
I think everyone has their own beliefs or their own creature or spirit who you talk to in at the time of some disturbing time, you know. And I truly believe. I'm a believer. Let's let's put it like this.
That's a song. Yeah, I agree. It is very personal. I'm hesitant to go into it for that reason. There's something very intimate about it, and it's between oneself and one's experience of God or experience of the divine. But because your story is so exceptional, and that was what I meant for myself, that I'd have been praying a lot. I didn't mean that I would be praying for a miracle, although that too, but I meant that when everything is stripped away and one's existence is so stark, it seems the only thing that can relieve that despair, as you just said, is to find and deepen one's connection to the divine.
Yes, and the more desperate time, the more you believe, and the stronger you get. And but you have to have. I have my own deal with the spirit. You know, I talk to, and I think every person has their own way how he deal with with him.
including avoiding dealing at all. Yeah, there's a. I don't know if you've heard it. It's an old English saying. There are no atheists in foxholes.
No, never heard.
It's a reference to the wartime. You know, foxholes were the things that soldiers had to hide in when the bombs were coming.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I think we covered the important points.
Mm-hmm.
So, I know. I was curious, coming back to when we started, because now you're in the US, and do you find that people's idea about the USSR is very insufficient, shall I say? I mean, do you find that Americans have a really distorted view of what life in Russia was like, and that they're surprised by Because I was quite surprised when you described everybody being happy and everybody having what they needed. And so have you noticed that sort of tension being in the US, that people have this misconception about what Russia was like back then?
Not really. I couldn't. I can tell that they have a misconception. Of course, they associated Russia with communism, and I don't think it's the right thing because there was no communism. Never. There was like a maybe the view they were hoping to get communism, but it was more socialistic socialism, and I think all the points of view were made by the Cold War, and people still think it's still the same, maybe. I don't know. But right now they're all into Putin, I guess. It's, I just don't like talking politics at all because it's so controversial and you never know.
Who are you going to piss off? Yeah, no kidding.
All the views are different and.
Okay, well, enough said then. We won't.
I'm happy I'm here. That's what I would like to tell you for sure, that I'm really, really happy in the light of the everything that is going on in Russia right now. I am the happiest person that I am, witnessing it from the TV or radio or whatever. I'm happy to be here.
And you don't visit Russia?
Never, never, never since I came here in 2000, never been.
You didn't look back.
Maybe someday, but not yet.
And is your mother happy in the US?
Yes, she is very happy.
Did she have to learn English?
She knows a little bit, yeah, but she when you don't practice language, you kind of losing it. And she her friends are all Russian ladies, so.
Oh, she has her own little Russian clique there in Ohio, is that?
Clique? What?
Clique, that's like a circle of friends.
There are Russian stores and people, lots of people. The community is quite big here too, so she communicates with them.
That's the end of the podcast for this week. I would like to thank Jay Ridley for funding this week's podcast and next week's too. And everyone who has donated over the months and years, help support this. Prisoner Infinity is now available. It has been for a month, but officially Amazon was saying it wasn't available till April 30th. If you haven't already, to order the book, give it a read, give it a review. And if you're interested in the Jordan Peterson Project, let me know, as it's an opportunity to be involved in the creative process itself. I'm working on a series of essays, but there's research and revising, expansion to be done as I proceed. So it's really not at all fully formed. And I can see many different ways that this could develop, so many different levels. So don't be shy about reaching out. Send me an email at jason@protonmail.com or jason@horticulture.com, or sign up to join the Facebook group. That's Facebook groups of Save Jordan Peterson, is the name of it. It's easy to find. There you'll find out a bit more about the nature of this experiment, which is about much more than just Jordan Peterson. Obviously, an interest and knowledge of Jordan Peterson is essential to participating. Okay, next week I will be talking once again with Gregory Desolet. Thanks for listening. This is the Liminalist Podcast Between.